Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Vice President Dick Cheney has reportedly become a focus of the special investigation into whether anyone in the White House leaked the name of undercover CIA agent Valerie Plame. Indictments could come this week as the grand jury draws to a close on October 28th. And yesterday, the reporter at the center of the story, the New York Times' Judith Miller, wrote a first-person account of what she told prosecutors, which shocked many inside and outside her newsroom because at times she could not recall who her source was. Joining us on the line from Washington is John Mercurio, senior editor of The Hotline, the daily political briefing of the National Journal. John, who is reporting that the vice president has become a focus of the investigation, and what charges might he face?
The report is coming out of Bloomberg, which is a wire service, as we know. It's owned by New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. A reporter named Richard Kyle, who's been covering the White House for quite a while, is reporting today that people that he's talking to who are, quote, familiar with the probe are looking into the possibility that the vice president might have had some dealings, might have been in some ways involved in conversations with Scooter Libby, his chief of staff, or deputy chief of staff at the White House, Karl Rove, to discredit Joe Wilson, who, of course, is the ambassador who wrote the New York Times article questioning the president's justification for going to war. A lot of the basis for the article that's appearing again in Bloomberg is the fact that there are several of Cheney's top aides, former and current top aides, people like his communications advisor, his former spokesperson, and a former White House aide who worked for him, who have been called before the grand jury that's doing this investigation. There doesn't seem to be at this point, though, any clear indication that the president or the vice president could face charges. His name just might come up as an unindicted co-conspirator. A lot of this, of course, remains unknown. We'll know a lot more in the next couple of weeks.
Well, Judith Miller also wrote about this subject in her piece yesterday, saying that Fitzgerald, the head of the commission, asked her if Libby indicated that Cheney knew of or approved his conversations with her. Now, Judith Miller, we should hasten to add, said no.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So she mentioned she was asked about Dick Cheney in her testimony.
Right, she did say no, but you raised an important point, which is that the prosecutor is in some ways sharpening his focus on the vice president. So whether or not she knew of anything specific that the vice president's chief of staff, Scooter Libby, might have known or might have told her, her revelation or the revelation that he was at least asking her those questions shows that there's at least at this point some focus on the part of Fitzgerald on the vice president.
Well, we're wondering, John Mercurio, if you can help us clear up some questions about Judith Miller, who attempted for clarity in an article she wrote in the New York Times, but it seemed to raise many questions. She writes that in a different part of her notebook from the notes she took of conversations with Scooter Libby, that she had written the name Valerie Flame with an F. It's, of course, Valerie Plame. At another point, she wrote Valerie Wilson. But she says she doesn't know her source for jotting down those names. What are people saying about that?
There are a lot of questions today among journalists, among media critics and media analysts about exactly how somebody, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, very well-respected in some ways and very accountable reporter for the New York Times, could have a source, could have gained that sort of information, obtained that information from a source, and at this point not remember who the source was. You have to imagine she's spent the past 22 months trying to reexamine in her head who that source might have been. So again, a lot of questions about that.
Yeah, is there a feeling that either, I'm just throwing out some thoughts that might be raised, that the name came from Mr. Libby, but she can't quite remember, or she talked to someone else?
Well, again, that sort of goes back to the whole negotiation that she had with the special prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, in gaining her release from jail. She would only agree to testify before his grand jury if he would agree, the prosecutor would agree, to limit his investigation or limit his questions in her testimony to her conversations with Scooter Libby, which does in some ways indicate that she has other sources, other confidential sources that she didn't want to bring into this investigation, didn't want to bring into this whole ordeal And that source might be the source that she obtained the information about Valerie Flame from.
John Mercurio is a senior editor of The Hotline. It's a daily political briefing of the National Journal. And today everybody is talking about the Valerie Flame case. Just in the minute or so we have, where might this all be leading? Originally it was thought it would be to a source in the White House who said her name. Now it seems that at least some of the sources did not actually say her name. So where might this all be going?
Right. I think, right, exactly. Originally, there was a lot of conversation about this exposing a CIA operative, which, of course, carries serious penalties. Again, as everyone has always said in Washington, it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. And now focus seems to be much more so on obstruction of justice or perjury charges.
As you said, conspiracy, possibly.
Or conspiracy, exactly. We know that the prosecutor is looking at a letter that Scooter Libby sent to Judy Miller last month, in which he seemed to imply that the public reports that he has seen about his testimony or about other reporters' testimony didn't implicate him in any wrongdoing, which the prosecutor thinks might suggest that he was trying to influence Ms. Miller to testify the same way. And she said in her account yesterday that that's actually not true, that, you know, they did have a conversation. She and he did have a conversation about Valerie Plame. There was some concern that he was trying to influence her testimony there.
John Mercurio, senior editor of The Hotline. John, we'll be checking back in with you as this keeps taking on new life. Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you.
And now to Iraq. Though ballots are still being counted in Baghdad, it appears as if Iraqi voters have approved a new constitution. Sunni voters were the key in this vote, and early results suggest that many more Sunnis went to the polls than last January. And while many chose to vote no, they appear to have been unable to muster the numbers necessary to defeat the charter. Pam Hess is Pentagon correspondent from UPI. She's recently back from several weeks in Iraq, has been following the voting there, and she joins us now. Pam, is that a pretty accurate assessment that, in fact, the Constitution is headed for passage?
It seems as though it is. I think early returns are showing that there might be two provinces that voted no on it, but it takes three to turn it down.
Yeah, and what is the sense of how the regions voted? Where Sunnis lived among Sunnis, they voted no. Where they lived among Shiites and Kurds, yes?
I think that's the case. It's not necessarily that Sunnis that lived among Shiites and Kurds voted yes, but they have to muster two-thirds of a majority to get it to turn down. So you could have had every Sunni saying no, but if they lived in a place that they didn't have a two-thirds majority population, it wouldn't make a difference.
Yeah. Well, are you surprised, by the way, by anything, by the turnout, by the vote? You spent a lot of time in several of the Sunni-dominated provinces.
I wasn't really surprised because the January vote, so many people turned out for the January vote, although obviously not in Sunni provinces. I expected there to be high turnout. The four Sunni provinces that everybody was sort of watching, I didn't quite know which way it was going to go, and I hate to even guess and stuff like this, but I think I had the sense that it would pass, and we'll see if that indeed comes to fore. There is a hunger on the part of Iraqis to just move forward, to do something different, to see if they can't get out of the problems that they're stuck in now and move on. So, there's been a lot of attention on this in the provinces, and so it's not surprising. The opposition is not terribly organized; it's really kind of piecemeal. Mm-hmm. So they'd have to really mount an aggressive campaign, I think, in order to coordinate the numbers that they needed to turn it down.
And I just want to ask you, we're going to bring another voice into the conversation, but I just want to ask you, when we last spoke, you said something to the effect of you felt that it may not be such a bad thing if the Constitution did not pass,
yeah,
in that Sunnis could feel that they could accomplish a goal through the political process, and that in turn would maybe take some support away from the Sunni-led insurgency. Now it appears that it's likely to pass. So what do you think that means? I mean, as far as the insurgency and how Sunnis might read this?
Right. Much depends on how many Sunnis actually voted no and how the government now responds with the Constitution. Do they take this and say, in a way that's perhaps reminiscent about some that's gone on in the United States, hey, we have a mandate and now we get to go do this? Or do they reach out to the Sunnis and say, we know that this isn't quite the document you wanted, and we're going to work on it. And don't forget that we have another election coming up over there in December, where the Sunnis are going to vote for a new government, and they will be able to put a lot more of their voice into Baghdad. I think that's the time when you might see really big turnout on the part of the Sunnis.
Well, and we remind ourselves that there was a sort of last-minute reprieve where there was sort of something written in that said, by the way, we can change it.
Yeah, and I think that was important. But something else you don't want to overstate is exactly how closely this constitution was read by people. It didn't come out in its final form until just days before this, and there were changes even being made after it was published. So I'm just now getting some reports from battalion commanders that I was over with over the last 9 weeks, and all of them are pretty happy with the way things turned out, and all of them are actually interesting. They're not really interested in how it turned out. They're just glad that the process happened. They're very process-oriented. I don't think they care if it passes or not.
Well, we want to bring Leslie Gelb into the conversation, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's speaking to us from his home in New York City. And Leslie, you wrote in May of 2004 that it would be a mistake to try and turn Iraq into a state. You argued it should be a loose federation. Well, it seems as if Iraq is turning into a state with this passage of the Constitution. What's your sense of that?
Well, a federation is a state.
There you go.
We're a federation, too. And we have a United States. One is not mutually exclusive. In fact, in the case of Iraq, I strongly believe that you can't have a state without its being highly federalized or confederalized with a considerable amount of regional autonomy. But, you know, too many people get one confused with the other. We have a federal system. We started out with a federal system where the states did almost all the legislating.
Of course, the bigger fear in Iraq is that one of those loose parts of the federation would be the Sunni areas, which wouldn't have as much oil as the others and might not be as willing to share as perhaps U.S. states. In about the minute and a half we have, I'd love you to comment on that, because we're going to keep you here for several more minutes after that.
Yeah.
But, you know,
well,
that's the concern.
Look, that's why I argued rather strongly that the distribution of the oil should be put in the Constitution itself, and that the Sunnis should get more than they deserve on a population basis. And they should get not only revenues from present oil, but future oil as well. Don't make it ordinary legislation. Put it in the Constitution, where they'll have confidence that they can have continuing revenues. That's very important.
And have you seen what you wanted in the Constitution?
No. Yeah. No. Yeah. You know, we've got two problems. We can get into it later. Mm-hmm. Two problems at the core of all this. One, the Kurds and the Shia are not prepared to make generous offers to the Sunnis, because the Sunnis treated them like slaves for 200 years. They're getting even. They're having their day in court.
And the second problem, yep.
The Sunnis aren't prepared to recognize that the thing that they're advocating most, a strong central government, would be the kind of government that tended to their interests least, because it would be dominated by the Shias and the Kurds.
That's Leslie Gelb. He's President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. We're also speaking with Pam Hess from UPI, Pentagon correspondent. We'll be back with both of them. Now that the Constitution appears to have passed in Iraq, what's next? Including, by the way, the trial of Saddam Hussein, scheduled to start this week. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Iraqis went to the polls on Saturday, and early results suggest they have approved a new constitution for that country. And we've been talking about what that means with Pam Hess, Pentagon correspondent from United Press International, who spent 9 weeks in Iraq and the Sunni-dominated provinces getting a feel for the area, and Leslie Gelb, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, who's given a lot of thought to how the new Iraq should look. Leslie, we were just speaking to you about your concerns about the lack of wording about revenue sharing from oil in the new constitution. I want to just jump back to Pam for a second. Now that this constitution has appeared to pass, Pam, what do you see as some of the issues that might come back to bite people?
Obviously, oil is an issue. The Sunnis don't live in a place in general where there's a lot where there's oil. The oil tends to be in the Kurdish north and the Shiite south. And so all that the Sunnis have to offer really to this country, besides their talent, which is large, these are people who were working in the government. Besides their talent, what they have to offer is a scaling down of violence. so that's their big negotiation card. So it's the problem will be if the Kurds and the Shiites don't offer them something in exchange for that, there might be no reduction in the violence, because that's all they have to trade away. This is not to say that the Sunnis are controlling it and can turn it on and off, but they know where the bodies are buried, they know who's involved in this, and they could end it by handing over the right intelligence to the right people to allow all that violence to be disrupted.
Well, Leslie Gelb, I'm wondering if you are also concerned, you're both concerned about oil sharing, but about the role of religion in government, because it's hard for those of us sort of outside this issue to wrap our brains around how that's actually going to be resolved, because of the wording, which seems to say that people can take religion into consideration when practicing law.
No, there's no question that's right. That's another reason why I think the only way a future single Iraqi state is viable is to allow maximum regional autonomy, because the Kurds, for example, who are Sunnis, are very secular, and they're not going to accept strict Islamic law. They're just not going to do it. The Sunnis in the center are split. You have secular Sunnis, you have very religious Sunnis. In the south, that's a very tricky situation, because you have the strongest Shiites there in favor of Islamic law, and you have a lot of secular Shiites too, particularly the women, who really are about to take the short end of the pipe. So the religious factor basically works against minority rights, women's rights throughout the country, but would have less of an effect if you had regional governments, strong regional governments.
You see, it doesn't feel as if, let's say, the next step was some sort of a Supreme Court. They already have, you know, courts set in place, but how would it rule on issues that affect each region differently?
No, we aren't sure exactly how it would rule, because it depends who's going to be on the courts, like the discussion we're having now about our Supreme Court.
Right.
In the South, in the Shia South, they're bound to have clerks running the courts, in which case there would be Islamic law, and it would be to the detriment of women's rights. There's no question about it. In the North, you would have secular law, and the law up in Kurdistan is pretty good. It's pretty fair, and people are treated pretty equally. In the center, it's hard to say how the Sunnis would work it out. There's a problem with the Sunnis. I mean, not only do we have to make a terrific offer to them to see if it's possible to get them to compromise and be a part of a future government, but they have got to come to terms with their past and their future. They act as if you centralize the government in Baghdad, they're going to run it again the way they did for 200 years. But that's not going to happen. And they have not reconciled themselves to that.
Well, and Pam has given that. As we said, you spent some time in the region. You also spoke to military, U.S. military commanders there. What's the sense of whether or not this process is going to either calm down or inflame the insurgency?
I think that the temptation is to say, oh, there's a constitution, and therefore everything's going to settle down. Iraq is like a Rubik's Cube, and any change that you make in that cube has adumbrations on the other side of it that you can't see. One of the things I have been struck by in each of my three trips back there each year is that how you can't predict, Westerners, we just can't predict what the response is going to be to anything. And when we think that something is going to blow up, it goes just fine. And sort of the reverse is true. So I think that this is one small step towards some end, but it's throwing lots of new uncertainty into the mix, and we'll see what happens next.
Speaking of which, what happens the very next, this week, is the trial of Saddam Hussein. It begins on Wednesday, scheduled to begin on Wednesday. When you were there, what were people saying about that, Pam?
You know, it's interesting. I met actually a bunch of Sunnis who were glad that he was gone. I don't know if this is revisionist history, but a number of people told me, oh, their tribe tried to assassinate Saddam Hussein and failed, and so they were glad when the invasion came and toppled him, but now they aren't happy at all because it has turned into an occupation that's favoring the Shiites. There aren't a lot of people, as near as I could tell, who had anything really nice to say about Saddam Hussein. I didn't see his poster up anywhere, not in private houses, not publicly. People, I think, were glad to move on. We are so tempted here to look at that country and to see these, you know, religious differences and to paint them with a really broad brush, but there are so many different influences working on them. And one of the big influences was that Saddam Hussein wasn't really good for anybody unless you were very close to him. And actually being very close to him was one of the most dangerous places you could be.
Well, funny you mentioned, because later this week we're going to hear from a woman whose family was very close to Saddam Hussein. Her father was his pilot, and it was not a very good thing. So
And his sons had a very bad reputation, and people were quite afraid of him. So there's no one saying we want Saddam Hussein back, but every once in a while you will hear, hey, at least under Saddam Hussein we had some stability, we had some security. And it wasn't that it was a benevolent dictatorship at all, but people knew the rules. They knew in general how to avoid getting whacked. And what has happened with this occupation and with the invasion is that all those rules have changed. The U.S. in going in, whatever the intentions, ends up opening up a Pandora's box, and it's very hard to predict how to be safe, how to operate your life so that you are safe in the streets. And that's what people are sort of vibrating to.
That's Pam Hess, Pentagon correspondent for UPI. We also spoke with Leslie Gill, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Leslie. Why some soldiers coming home injured from Iraq are finding they're in debt to the government. We're going to take a look at that tomorrow on Here and Now. But stay with us. Much more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's a race against time to help the increasingly desperate survivors stranded in the areas hit by the Pakistani earthquake 9 days ago. In fact, one United Nations emergency official says the problem is basically beyond world response. The relief effort is slow for many and non-existent for others because of the difficult terrain and the rainy weather. Absar Alam is a correspondent for the daily newspaper The Nation in Pakistan. And Absar, first to the news today, we're hearing that Pakistan is willing to accept an offer from its bitter rival and neighbor, India, for helicopters, but they have not accepted Indian pilots for those helicopters. What does that tell you about Pakistan-Indian relations?
Actually, this is one of the major policy decisions by Pakistan taken today, because India had offered earlier, soon after the earthquake, that it can provide its helicopter support. But actually, this is one of the disputed areas, Kashmir, where the earthquake has hit. So Pakistan was reluctant, and also Pakistan was suspecting this Indian move, because militarily, this is the area where both the armies are eyeball to eyeball. So Pakistan was reluctant, but now this decision that they have accepted this offer, but they will use their own pilots. I think this is a win-win situation for both. Now India cannot make mileage out of it, and Pakistan, cannot make any excuse of not accepting Indian offers, which there have been some pressure on Pakistani government from both sides. Mm-hmm. But I think overall this will be taken as a good gesture by the people in Kashmir as well as people in India and Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And one hopes it might initiate or trigger a new era of peace and stability in the region.
Well, meanwhile, the situation in the region is deplorable. I mentioned the UN emergency official who said it's beyond world response. He also said there are not enough tents in the world for all of the survivors. We know that Oxfam has taken over a factory in Lahore. They're trying to produce 100 tents per hour, but it's still not enough for the people. You've been in the area, the affected areas, Absar. How are people living?
Actually, Robin, it's such a devastated situation there I haven't seen in my life ever. And I have talked to journalists here and some of the American military officials who have been involved in providing relief to affected of Katrina and then tsunami victims, and now they have arrived in Pakistan also to provide this support to earthquake victims. They said they have never seen such devastation ever in their life. And the problem is that cities after cities and towns after towns have been shattered, flattened to earth by this massive earthquake. And there have been living millions of people in those cities, and none of the house literally is livable now. I mean, about 90% of houses have demolished, and the remaining, they are not livable. And all the shops, all the schools, all hospitals, police stations, you name anything standing on any structure of concrete, it has been flattened to earth. Mm-hmm. So, and about more than 2 million people have directly been affected, and about more than, there are reports that the death toll may be more than 300,000.
I'm sorry, did you say 300,000?
Yes, I said 300,000. And officially they have accepted about 50,000 plus already, and there are some relief organizations which are claiming that they have themselves, one single AD foundation, they said they have buried more than 50,000 people. Mm-hmm. And also there are streets and towns and towns where, you know, dead bodies are still lying under the debris and they have not been recovered yet. And there are valleys and hamlets where no one has reached yet and no one knows how much is the scale of devastation there. It's a miserable situation. And as far as you ask how people are living in the open under the skies. The whole families, injured one, the children, women, they have lost everything in their houses, and the temperature is freezing right now at this time. Mm-hmm. And there have been rains for the last 2 days, and that actually brought the temperature down.
We're speaking with Absar Alam in Islamabad, who's been in the affected regions of the earthquake. And we understand that Mercy Corps doctors are trying to walk into the remote areas. Aid agencies are trying to get mules to help them bring supplies in. But I want to ask you something, Absar. We're understanding that U.S. response to the relief effort has been less than people expected or hoped for. Americans have only contributed about $6 million to something like $250 million U.N. fund. Are Pakistanis, speaking to that?
The issue is people right now, the people who have been affected directly, they are not actually, they don't know what is happening all over the world. Actually, they are just looking for their loved ones who are still under the debris. I mean, until yesterday, survivors were being rescued alive from the debris. And people, you know, they are more concerned to bury their bury the dead bodies and get their injured to the doctor or to a hospital. Hospitals are not available, so at least they want some kind of first aid for their injured ones, and then they need food, and then they need tents, and then the blankets. Only then they will start looking for other things. I mean, right now, you know, after 9 days, this is the devastation. Is after 9 days still the people are suffering, and this is being considered here as an earthquake within an earthquake. The situation is so bad that people have not even been recovered from what this started suffering 9 days ago. So this is a major problem. They are not looking for what world is doing for them, and definitely world is not doing enough for them. But they also have complained about their own government, which has not done enough for them. And there have been widespread complaints that foreign aid workers and foreign rescue workers, they arrived much more before their own people who could have, who should have come there earlier. And also, this is people are unable to understand why this is the most heavily militarized region in Pakistan, and the military was present all everywhere, but still they couldn't reach well in time. And when they reached, they didn't have enough tools and skill to rescue people alive or to provide them aid and medicines. But that's true, that level of devastation is so huge, no military in the world could have done it single-handedly. But still, you know, there should have been much more organized efforts even after 9 days. People see little coordination and little organization in the relief worker. But what's one of the positive points is the people, the civilian people from all over the country, they rushed with food and medicines. But as you just mentioned, that there are not enough tents available all over the world for all these people. So this is a major worry, because they need winterized tents, not only tents, but winterized tents where they could survive in this freezing temperature.
Absar Alam is a correspondent for the Pakistani daily newspaper, The Nation. He's been telling us that officials there are privately saying that the death toll in the aftermath of the earthquake may go to 300,000. Absar, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And as always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. And still to come, Cynthia Lennon on John, Yoko, and finding them together in her home. You're listening to Here and Now. The Supreme Court ruled today on its first abortion-related case under new Supreme Court Justice John Roberts. The justices upheld the right of a Missouri inmate to terminate her pregnancy. Well, joining us with more is Here and Now Supreme Court watcher Lyle Denniston. Lyle, we understand part of Missouri's arguments focused on the cost of the procedure, the abortion, to the state. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, the state of Missouri does not want to be involved in assisting any action that would support abortion, but as alternative arguments for why they didn't want to take this woman away from the prison to obtain an abortion, they said it would be about $350 in cost for gasoline and other costs associated with traveling to St. Louis from Vandalia, Missouri, where the prison is located, and that the prison safety might suffer because she would have to have two guards, and that would reduce the number of guard personnel left back at the prison. Mm-hmm. It seems fairly clear that the argument about cost and safety were subordinate arguments, that the state was primarily interested in enforcing its policy against abortions with any assistance from the state.
And by the way, in citing the costs, they were saying that by law they couldn't spend taxpayers' money on abortions.
That's a prohibition in state law. It would appear that, however, this woman can get a free abortion from a Planned Parenthood clinic or from another clinic in the St. Louis area if she's free to be taken there. And today's order by the Supreme Court means that she must be taken within the next 48 hours to have an abortion.
Well, Lyle Denniston, Justice Clarence Thomas had issued a temporary stay on Friday to prevent that abortion from taking place this past Saturday. But we understand that today's Supreme Court decision allowing the abortion came down without a dissent. So just briefly, what do you think this case says, if anything, about how this court is going to rule on abortions?
Well, I think in this case, it probably doesn't tell us a whole lot about where we go from here, because at this stage, it is already clear that the state of Missouri allowed other patients who have medical conditions, other inmates who had medical conditions, to be taken away from the facility in order to have those. It had just singled out abortion, and whatever one may think about the virtue of the right to abortion, this unequal treatment of one inmate may have been the factor that was most persuasive for the court. Also, Robin, we can't read too much into the fact that there were no publicly recorded dissents, because in this kind of an order, the court doesn't feel a need to publish how the nine justices vote.
Well, we want to, in the minute we have, talk to you about the government's case against the tobacco industry, which took a big hit today. This was a win for the tobacco industry, and that the Supreme Court refused to hear the federal government's appeal, trying to get the tobacco industry to surrender $280 billion in profits. Does this mean that the tobacco industry might never have to cough up, forgive the pun, that penalty?
Well, this means that they will never have to cough up that much money in this case filed by the government, because the action by the Supreme Court today in denying review takes that that profit surrendering order off the table. It has a secondary effect as well. It means that that the case will now go forward in district court, and indeed the tobacco industry may never have to do anything to satisfy the government's complaints, because so far, the district judge who's been handling this case has not yet ruled that the tobacco industry did violate the federal anti-racketeering law. So that's an issue that remains to be decided. And then if the judge does find that the industry had violated the anti-racketeering law, then the judge will have to confront what alternative remedies to the surrender of profits she will order.
Here and Now, Supreme Court watcher Lyle Denniston on two actions from the Supreme Court today. Lyle, they're not wasting any time.
They're not. They dove right in. They got a youthful Chief Justice, and they're getting busy early.
Lyle, thank you.
All right.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. JohnLennon.com debuted today, billing itself as the official site of the late Beatle. It's managed by his second wife, Yoko Ono, and not surprisingly, it doesn't seem to feature much mention of his first. If you're a certain age, you can picture her, long blonde hair, big sunglasses, and smile, one step behind her husband as they disembark from planes, visit the Maharishi in India. For many, Cynthia Lennon was the fifth Beatle, until, as she says, she was airbrushed out of the picture when she was replaced by Yoko Ono. Cynthia's new book tells of largely happier times, their 10-year marriage, her front seat on their huge success, and then the descent. With a foreword by their son, Julian, it's called Simply John, and Cynthia Lennon joins us now from Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin. I'm very happy to be here.
Why did you write this book?
It was for Julian, basically. I wanted to express to Julian in words and in writing the things that I couldn't actually tell him, you know, in everyday conversation. When he actually wrote the foreword, I didn't ask him to do it, but he wanted to do it. And when I read it, I mean, I was in tears at the things that he'd said about me and the sadness of how he felt about his father and his neglect. And the most important thing was, you know, that John had a lot of love for the rest of the world, but very little for his son.
He writes, Dad was a great talent, a remarkable man, but while he was fast becoming one of the wealthiest men in the world, Mum and I had very little, and she was going out to work to support us. She always acted with dignity, and I have to thank her for who I am. Right at the beginning, you give us foreshadowing of what's to come. It's a few pages on the day that John Lennon was shot. You're in England. Julian is devastated, heading for New York, and you tell Yoko on the phone that you're worried and would like to come, and she says what?
Oh, she actually said, well, if you come, then Julian doesn't come because it's not as if you're an old school friend of mine, which I was absolutely devastated by that kind of comment. But then I had to back off because I was saying to Julian, look, can you cope with doing this journey on your own? Can you handle it? He said, Mum, I don't care. I've got to go. I've got to be near my dad. It was the most tragic thing that I had to do, to leave him at the airport, to know that on the flight over from Manchester it was, that everybody was reading the newspapers and every headline and photograph on the front page was that of his slain father. And that was the reason I wanted to go with Julian, to give him support.
But Yoko says you cannot come, and that sets the stage for what we're going to find was just a really uncomfortable divorce. But before that, there were 10 years. You were art students together. You were living poor as church mice, going to art school. You became pregnant, married, had the child. All the time living this, it sounded like just a wonderful life of two young people starting out.
Well, it was fun, and we went through the wartime as children. And what followed the war were the very grey, dark days. And then, of course, it was as though the sun came out in the late 50s. Everything changed. Everything went from black and white film to Technicolor. The joy of being young in a world of peace at that time as well was reflected in their music.
And you were a part of it. You mentioned, for instance, a Christmas card at one point that John Lennon wrote to you, I love you, yes, yes, yes. You must have heard that reflected in the hit song.
Well, yes, in a lot of them.
You think you've lost your love? Well, I saw her yesterday. It's you she's thinking of, and she told me what to say.
It's sort of a typical story, you know, about a woman who supports a man's career. And then in 1 year, you go from struggling to meeting the Queen. You know, all the world is on his platter. And
in every respect.
Yes, women and an exotic, mysterious Japanese artist.
I think he needed his freedom, his mental freedom. And I think by taking drugs, when he did take the drugs, the acid, it released him. It gave him mental freedom. But it also made him very vulnerable and very surreal in many ways. Whereas I was more or less feet on the ground, the same as I always was, growing, hopefully, at the right rate with what was going on, what was happening in our lives. But John always was the searching one. John always wanted to find more because he had lost so much in his life.
Yes, you both lost parents, in fact, and every Beatle fan knows that John was raised by his Aunt Mimi. You and others portray her as cold and domineering. But none of that was on your mind when you came home from a trip with friends to find John in your house with Yoko Ono in your bathrobe.
I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I couldn't believe that the vision of John and Yoko, who had been obviously there all night together, sitting on the floor cross-legged. So I was absolutely dumbstruck and made the most stupid comment about, hi, would you like to come out for dinner? And John looked up at me and said, no, thanks. And that was it.
It unraveled from there. You know, Cynthia Lennon, psychologists would have a field day with the aunt that you portray who raised John and the woman that he embraced, Yoko Ono.
Yes, well, I think there was, in hindsight, I mean, as I was writing the book, it really sort of evolved and it enlightened me that the strength or the power of the woman, the women in his life, John needed that. I feel that I was the calming influence on his life, you know, the balm to soothe the pain. But that was not enough for John. He needed far more. He needed someone to tell him what to do. In fact, you know, eventually he called Yoko mother, which, you know, I think says everything.
Well, hello, even after all these years, I miss you when you're not here. I wish you were here, my dear Yoko.
He didn't see Julian for 3 years?
No, it was 4 years. Eventually, when he left England, they decided to move to New York.
Cynthia Lennon, talking about her new memoir, it's called John. Why are you writing this now?
Well, I think there's not a lot of time left. You know, I'm getting on a bit. I've got my bus pass. I'm a pensioner. And that whenever books were written, or whenever plays or films or documentaries were done, it was as though we were people we didn't know. So I felt it was my duty and my responsibility to write the book that is from my heart and from my experience.
You also write, and I'm going to paraphrase here at the end of the book, that except for your beautiful son Julian, if you had known as a teenager who met this fellow in art school what it was going to mean to be John Lennon's wife, to be part of the Beatlemania, you would have turned on your heel and walked away.
Yes, I would have done on that level, not on the level of the wonderful experiences that I've had, but for the tragedy and the loss and the sacrifices.
Do you still feel love for him?
I still feel immense affection for him and great sadness at such a tragic loss, a loss to the world in terms of music and what could have been, a loss to my son and his son for the good times and the musical times and the conversation that they could have had together. And John could have grown old and got to know his children much better. I always lived in hope, you know, that would happen. But then, of course, you know, a murderer's bullet took that dream away and that hope away.
Author Cynthia Lennon, her new book about her 10-year marriage to John Lennon is called John.
Ever since you've been leaving me,
The Music of Julian Lennon, Here and Now, is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.